Okay, so welcome again to Adelaide Chronicles, Nick. You're an expert in anxiety of our population. There's plenty of that around at the moment, isn't there?
Look, you know, I would use the argument there is now, there always will be, and there always has been. You know, that's an anxiety to a degree plays a very important role in our life. For most of us, for most of the time, it plays a very positive role. But there comes a point for some people where that level of anxiety, I use the phrase with a lot of my patients, goes from improving our lives to impairing our lives, or the other way is from helping us to hindering us. And that kind of goes back to some famous work done by two, I believe they were English psychologists in the early 1900s by the names of Yerkes and Dodson. They came up with a very famous curve called the Yerkes-Dodson curve, which is kind of like a bell-shaped curve. And on the axis that's vertical, we'll call that one anxiety, and the horizontal axis, we'll call that performance. And we notice as the anxiety goes up, our actual performance improves. But there comes a point where that performance peaks and then begins to go down on the other side. And that's where our anxiety can become impairing. So that's one of the ways I try and separate with a lot of my patients. We spend a lot of time talking about what's normal, healthy anxiety and what's maybe what we call pathological or anxiety that's no longer helpful but harmful.
So last time you mentioned the lions and tigers at the door. So that's normal anxiety, is it?
Look, I think if you have lions and tigers at your doorstep, you should be anxious, and that's going to cause what we call fear, because, you know, fear is a more what we call a rationally based fear. You can see the danger ahead of you, and it tends to be pretty much more factually based. Where anxiety is more future based, or often can be past based. How did I perform in a situation? Did I say or do the right thing? Or, you know, being in a traumatic event such as physical assault or a sexual assault or motor vehicle accident, thinking about that, having flashbacks, intrusive memories or ruminations. So really I think about anxiety being about past or present. Fear tends to be more current or present based.
If we look at the scenario that's been presented to us about this COVID-19 crisis that we're in. One of the people, John, left his job because of his fear of catching virus and passing it on to his pregnant wife. That's a logical fear to have, would you say?
Well, you know, I do think, you know, this is a conversation I've had with a lot of my patients. A lot of the fear around COVID-19 been rational or irrational? And I think, as a clinician, I would argue quite a bit of it has been rational, but there's also been some irrational fear. And I think you see the irrational fear when you see people fighting in major supermarkets over toilet paper.
Yes.
And, you know, the irrational fear is, you know, or the irrational anxiety, sorry, I should say, is where we just don't make logical decisions. Our emotions override our capacity to think in a clear, logical manner. And that's kind of where we surrender control of our actions to our emotions. And we often know that when we do that, we often do not always make the best decisions. So I think using hand sanitizer, being cautious at work, trying to be safe, trying not to spread, use social distancing, those are quite rational behaviors. Walking into Coles and Woolies or any major supermarket, you know, buying 50 rolls of toilet paper, buying, you know, 300 containers of hand sanitizer, I think that's the kind of irrational behavior. And that's where the person, one of the ways I think about this, is no longer thinking about their community, but their amygdala, their kind of threat assessment center, is so hyper-aroused, they no longer think about the community. It's just about, how do I survive?
In John's case, The fear, though, is very real of catching the virus and passing it on to his wife, isn't it?
It is. So one of the things that I just like to mention that I think has possibly played a role, and I can't remember if I mentioned this earlier, and I apologize if I did, but I think it is the fact that it was only a few months ago that we came out of the worst bushfires in the last 40 years in Australia. And I think we've got to give COVID-19 some context in relation to that. You know, that was such a traumatic event for a nation.
Absolutely.
And okay, I'll agree, not all of us were directly affected, but in many ways, indirectly affected. And everyone's trying to survive that event and try to deal with that grief and that trauma and begin to heal, and all of a sudden, we're hit with a global pandemic. So I think it caught us at an incredibly vulnerable time psychologically, and I think that partly explains why we saw such irrational panic behavior. Because people hadn't got back to their baseline of wellness or normal functioning. And so it was easy to tip us over as a nation, per se.
And the incredible drought that the country had suffered prior to that, the incredible way that whenever there is a climate event, it's a disastrous one now.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the best ways I've heard it explained by, I cannot remember the gentleman being interviewed by one of my favorite podcast people, Sam Harris, as they were discussing the concept of climate change and as the world evolves, what this gentleman pointed out was what we really need to wrap our heads around is, you know, the 1 in 100 year events, the 1 in 100 year floods, the 1 in 100 year fires, the 1 in 100 year cyclones, they're no longer 1 every 100 years. Those cycles are shortening.
Yes.
Therefore, the amount of trauma we as individuals and we as populations experience is more frequent, and therefore we see a rise in what I would call our baseline level of anxiety or fear. And part of that is, you know, anxiety, but part of it's fear, because we are facing these consequences more frequently. You know, we are now facing the, you know, greatest economic instability in potentially 90 years. Some of the highest unemployment rates. And how are we as a country going to do that? Or actually, we as a world going to deal with that?
All of these levels of anxiety are quite predictable, but there's a whole lot of people who, I'd imagine, their anxiety has doubled because they were pretty much neglected in our society in the first place. And so with this on top of it, like the long-term unemployed, for argument's sake, people who want a job but can't find a job.
You know, I do think, you know, that highlights something that is been made so crystal clear when we look at COVID-19. And I will only speak to kind of the US data because that's data I've looked at more. One of the most, I guess, distressing and disturbing set of statistics that's come out of the US is when you look at certain populations, and we're going to talk about, I guess, the three probably most marginalized populations, the African-American population, the Hispanic American, and the Native American. No one of those groups represents more than 15 or 20% of any population of any major city or town or state, but they are obscenely overrepresented in the people who are getting COVID-19 and who are potentially dying from it. So, you know, not only are they financially marginalized, but access to healthcare, they're marginalized, access to education, they're marginalized. You know, so they have really taken the brunt of this virus. They also, you know, when you kind of come to like the US, they also have less access to healthcare. And I think that's something that we in Australia need to think about more, as we are seeing the rates of people who are privately uninsured drop with greater demands on our public health system.
Yes.
Which is a great health system, I believe. But as more and more people rely upon it, its resources become stretched. And we, as a nation, need to be thinking about that moving forward.
So, is one of the reasons for the virus affecting those people particularly about density? High density living?
I think it's multifactorial. So, one, I would argue, if you're in lower socioeconomic groups, you tend to probably live in environments where there is greater density of housing. There is greater prevalence of baseline levels of diseases. There are greater levels of unemployment, which means greater or less access to money, which means less access to a better diet, less access to medications, less access to medical facilities if there are co-payments, less access to medications given co-payments, more likely to have comorbidities because of poor education, so more likely to drink more likely to smoke more likely to really appreciate how one can minimize one's risks from getting an illness such as an infectious disease. So I think the kind of the deck is stacked against those populations for a variety of reasons.
And that would be the case pretty much everywhere, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
Mm. But yeah, the data's available and we get it daily from the United States.
Yeah, I mean, and when you're looking at some of the data I've seen where you see, especially the stuff I've seen on the African-American population, you know, one of the other interesting stats they talk about with the marginalized population, I believe the stat is 83% of African-Americans are in a job, but they cannot work from home. So again, that's another factor. Yeah, it's fine if you're well-educated and you've got a profession and you can work from home and do teleconferencing, you've got all the computer system and all the software, but what if your job is hospitality? What if your job is really frontline? And we know that those jobs are more likely to be people that are going to be in lower socioeconomic groups, lower rates of education, and you know, those people are forced, because of economics, to maintain themselves on the front line, to keep the bills paid, to keep the family fed.
Yes. So as a nation, what can we do? Is there anything particularly that we can do?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that the Australian government, to its credit, has tried to do for a long time, and this has been despite who's in power, is really try and find a way to grow the Australian literacy or understanding of major mental health issues. And this has been on the agenda since the year 2000, when literally just before the year 2000, the World Health Organization basically said by 2020, which is the year we find ourselves in now, the two greatest causes of morbidity or illness and mortality, death, facing the world globally, no longer in the West, but as a global nation, are going to be heart disease and mental health disease. And what's interesting is both are a significant risk factor for the other. So if you have mental health issues, you have a significant increased risk of heart disease. We know that from a lot of brilliant studies of people who have depression, that they are potentially at increased risk of developing heart disease. And we also know that people who develop heart disease are at a significant rate of developing mental health problems, post-heart problems. And we now find ourselves in the year 2020, where globally, mental health has become one of the top three players in most nations. Unfortunately, it doesn't receive the funding that's equivalent to that.
The staggering, that was in 2000.
Yeah, so this was really the prediction 20 years ago by the World Health Organization. that we really needed to be thinking about mental health as a major player for illness and death, facing, as I said, the world, not the West, but the world, East and West. And one of the things that statistics, and which I guess has been one of the most saddening statistics over those 20 years, is that suicide rates in most countries have been climbing over that 20-year period. Anywhere from 15 to 25% potentially. So it tells us we are struggling mentally, not only just with anxiety, but with depression. And despite having newer treatments available, rates of suicide have climbed. And I think one of the people that really highlighted some of the wonderful issues with that was the English writer Johann Hari, who wrote the wonderful book Lost Connections, or Lost Connections, a few years ago, where he highlighted the fact that we culturally are becoming just disconnected from each other. And despite the fact that we have, quote, social media that's meant to unite us and bring us all together, it's probably divided us more, isolated us more, and added to our mental health problems rather than helped them. Having said that, there are some positive things in regards to the internet, you know, the idea that, you know, in today's world, given this crisis, we can use telehealth, we can use teleconferencing, you know, we've been able to respond to COVID-19 in a way that we never could have 50 years ago. So I'm not saying everything's negative about these changes. There have been wins, some great wins, but there have also been some losses.
And it's a completely different way, well, for me anyway, of thinking about things. I mean, everything is connected. It just reinforces that, doesn't it?
It does. You know, at the end of the day, you know, I always find it interesting that the pet most people will seem to enjoy most are dogs. And I hope I haven't upset any cat owners out there. But I do find it interesting that, you know, human beings, I often say to a lot of people, we're just like dogs. We're a pack animal. We thrive in the presence of others. We struggle, or we're more likely to struggle, in isolation. And this is one of the big things that Johann Hari pointed out in his book, Lost Connections, that really, over the last 20, 30 years, what we've been doing is we're losing our social connections. And there's no antidepressant that's going to regrow your social connections. This is something that we as communities need to respond to. And I think this partly goes back to the talking about John and being unemployed. You know, it's not just about giving John access to money, but it's also helping John understand for his mental health, even though he's unemployed, he can still be an active member of his community.
And that's something that we don't do well enough.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's a conversation I have with many people. You know, yes, I work for a living as a doctor, but, you know, that's not my only role in life. You know, I'm a partner, I'm a parent, I'm a member of a community, I'm a friend, I'm a support for other people. There's many roles I play. One of them is I do work, but that's by far not the only thing that I do with my life, and it's certainly not the only thing that gives me great joy in my life.
And it doesn't define you?
No, not at all. I think sadly for a lot of men, especially in a country like Australia, that still is a major definer. And that's one of the things that we need to work hard on redefining and putting greater value on other things. You know, work is important for our mental health, but there are many ways to work. Some is paid, some is as a volunteer, some is working within a community, there's work within family. You know, there's so many ways to work.
And yes.
Yeah, there's a wonderful woman in America by the name of Catherine, I believe it's pronounced Hoke, H-O-K-E. And she, for many years, has run a program based on working with people who have been incarcerated for prolonged periods. And one of the big issues she's been trying to tackle is how do we work with people who have been in prison for a long time, and how do we reduce recidivism rates? And one of the important things that she has talked about, that's a cornerstone of a lot of her work, and has really shown that, look, if you do this work, you can reduce recidivism rate of criminals to less than 10%. And she'd tell you at the cornerstone of all her work and all her research, what you actually have to give people is a sense of hope, a sense of purpose.
Yes.
But without hope, without purpose, we're lost. And we find it hard to be motivated to follow rules. Because we feel, what's the point? There's a wonderful, I do watch quite a few TED Talks, I do enjoy them, a TED Talk by a fellow by the name of Aaron Huey, H-U-E-Y, who documents the history of the Sioux Nation in America from the mid-1800s to current day. And you know, the history of the Sioux Nation, like with our indigenous population here in Australia, is not a pretty history.
Mm.
It's a history of brutality, it's a history of broken treaties. And as he said, we now look at the Sioux Nation and we see in the 2000s, the average life expectancy of a male who's a member of the Sioux Nation living on tribal lands is just above 40 years. And one of the questions he talks about is, well, there is a lot of drug abuse, there is a lot of violence, crime, mental health issues, suicide and homicide. And as he points out, well, are we that surprised when we're talking about five generations that have been held prisoners of war? You know, five generations that have not had hope. And his work, I think, again, just reinforces Catherine's work about if you want to build healthy communities, if you want people to really feel a sense of value, you've got to give them hope and you've got to give them purpose.
I think that's an amazing place to end here. That's really food for thought.
Hopefully so.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You're welcome.